My name's David Bella. I'm from Oregon State University, and I do research in the environmental area. I'd like to talk about today, not too formally, but present a few ideas, at least, on what I see. Come on right in. The environmental movement, and I'd like you to throw in some ideas if you'd like, and maybe toward the end we can see where it goes. And the environmental movement began in the 60s, I guess, although I guess you can point to environmentalists going all the way back to biblical times. And I think it began, at least it seemed to be initiated, as I recall, by a particular book by a woman by the name of Rachel Carson. Silent Spring. So she kind of set off an explosion. And she was a scientist and also very much an artist and poet. She wrote very artistically as well as scientifically. And she wrote the book Silent Spring, which dealt with mainly with pesticides and herbicides that were being used rather widespread. She faced a considerable amount of abuse from her professional colleagues on this. And I believe it was a few years later she did die, so she's not living now. But it turns out that despite all the abuse that she did face from her professional colleagues, that much of what she had to say, at least in general, has turned out to be accepted. She was very popular, her writings were very popular, and that triggered off, I think, a broader environmental concern that lasted and grew through the 1960s. In a sense, I guess the environmental movement kind of rode along with the civil rights movement. Probably the civil rights movement was probably at the core of most of the movements at that time, probably Martin Luther King being probably the single strongest figure. It was a time of turmoil. For those of you who recall, a tremendous amount of social change. I had gone to school in the South, went to the Virginia Military Institute in 1957 and graduated in 61. And the racial policies back then in Virginia were horrible. And people were killed for objecting to it. And I had a friend that was killed. So things did change over that era. We also had the anti-Vietnam War movement. And I think we can remember demonstrations and riots. And it was a time of turmoil. And part of this turmoil was what is known as the environmental movement. And it was characterized by a high degree of emotions, a large amount of demonstrations, particularly by young people on university campuses. And now it seems to be all gone. Certainly that part of it is. Things have changed. The mood has changed. I think that now we don't have quite as much of the high emotional kind of hope. There seems to be, among the younger people, a little more cynicism than I think there was then. But nevertheless, I think the environmental movement of the 60s did influence our values. They had an influence. They were true, high on emotions. Quite often, many of their arguments did not have the depth. But they did influence, I think, our concerns. Each one of us, and they have had an influence on the professional disciplines, a considerable influence. And I think if we're going to see what happened to the environmental movement now in the 70s, which I'd like to talk about, we're going to have to recognize some very significant differences between what's happening now and what's happening in the 70s, because the 70s right now are very different than the 60s in many, many ways. I think now we find that what might be called an environmental movement is not dominated by the youth. We have a wide range of people of all different age groups. In fact, it seems to me that quite often some of the older people are some of the most committed to this. There is less fanfare. There is a smaller core of more mature, more informed people who are working generally within the established laws, because there are some laws. And there's even kind of an underground communication system. I'll give you an example. There was a hearing in Salem, Oregon, which is the capital of Oregon, on a particularly important matter on coastal zone, on estuaries, on protecting a particular estuary, a bay, particular bay. And I got a call all of a sudden. They're holding a hearing. We need someone to to testify as a technical witness. Can you make it? And I said, yes, what time? You know, today. They told me what time. I got in the car, got up. I didn't even know who the person was who was on the phone. When I got up there, there were a bunch of people. Some of them I could recognize, and some of them I knew, some of them I didn't. Well, that kind of thing, I think, happens more. I think that when environmental concerns do come in front of the legislature, there seems to be kind of this underground movement with people on phone calls. How about come here, check on this? Things do happen like this. But there is a lot less fanfare. I think the people are more informed. And I also see that the environmental movement now has both greater depth and greater breadth. As an example, I think now the environmental concerns, as you find them in written literature, as among the people who are talking about environmental concerns, they're very closely tied with a broader concept of social justice. The question of income distribution, the question of the poor, the question of the third world nations. Now that is much more a part of what I see the environmental movement than it was in the 60s. I think in the 60s, and maybe even before in the 50s, you had small groups like the Sierra Club, for example, advocating protection of a certain area. Now I do see in literature and in people's concerns, I do see a smaller number of people who seem to have a much greater breadth and depth in their social concerns. So I think that's one of the changes that we do see right, or that I see right now. A major problem that we have now concerns getting technical experts. When there are laws and there are hearings and court cases, we find that in the environmental movement now, that quite often it is taken up in the courts or in public hearings. And in the courts and public hearings, you do need technical experts. And the environmental groups are often criticized, and quite often justly so, for not having done their technical homework. Well, on a complex issue, if you're going to do your technical homework, you have to have someone who has a background in that. That is becoming extremely difficult to get those kinds of people. Part of the reason, and one of the biggest reasons, is that most of the technical experts are hired or supported some way by the institutions that are involved in the controversy. So if you want to go ahead and there's a big chemical industry that you want to go ahead and an environmental group wants to go ahead and investigate what they're doing, or if there's a hearing concerning their permit for disposal, they have an extremely difficult time trying to find technical people who can go over the analysis of the waste and the treatment processes. They have a very difficult time getting those people, because for that particular waste, you'll find that the university people, for example, have consulting with that industry, so they won't do it. You find that the government people, generally, they're not allowed to work with them. And then you find that most of the other people are hired by the industry. So they have a very difficult time. But there are a few people out there, and I think, in general, they have to face quite a bit of harassment. The technical people have to do this. And in fact, some of them, if you look at their personal history, how they got involved in getting into these controversies, you can begin to understand it. Let me give you one story about one person who is an engineer who has gotten involved as technical expert on a number of concerns. Let me give you kind of the idea of the kind of person that sometimes comes into this kind of a movement.
Before you do that, I'd like to object to quite a few things that you said.
Good.
That rah-rah group that went around hollering, save the environment, they were not the real environmental people, really. Like you said, I grew up in a state where, for instance, contour plowing was encouraged to prevent erosion. Special grants were given to farmers to preserve the land in that way. You mentioned the Sierra Club, which I think you completely underplayed. That's also old. That was very effective.
I realize that.
I have been very active in environmental planning things in the county and state and local level. many of those were done long, long before all that rah-rah went on. You know, I don't think that, I think that group, in fact, I think in some ways they obscured the real environmental issue, and I'm glad it's over with.
Well, there's been a change, though, I think you have to realize in the 60s. Because you see, up until about 1960, let me give you one example, most of the waste that we dealt with had a natural decay to them within several days, for example, domestic waste, our own bodily waste, as an example. And within a period of 5 or 6 days, the majority of that waste was decayed. What Rachel Carson, I think, pointed out, which changed the name of the game, is that there were wastes that were now very persistent. There were wastes that were very global in nature. And that's kind of changed the whole ballgame. And I agree with you, there always has been, all the way back to biblical times and before, an environmental kind of activity. But as a movement, kind of an emotional movement, you're right, and quite often very weak in technical material, I think the 60s would have to be identified as a period where, of a high emotional state, whether you approve of what they did or not. And so my concern right now is what happened after that, okay? So maybe we're in more of agreement than... So you agree with
I
that?
I just wanted to say that I think that there was what I would call a more sensible and fundamental group that was working all the time, while this other group was around waving their banners and standing around trees that were going to get cut down and things like that.
I think you're right. And I think you are finding now that there are a large number of older people mm-hmm. who are involved now who have stayed in it. That's right. There were a lot of people in the 60s. It was a cause to join to. They jumped on the bandwagon and now they're gone. There's a lot of people now who have a more mature outlook towards it. However, I think that they're wrestling with problems that are quite different than, say, contour plowing. I think contour plowing is still important. The erosion, for example, is a major problem. But now we've got a whole host of problems that are just a whole new ballgame. And so I'd agree with you that there is a far more, compared with the 70s, with the 60s, I think there's a far wider age range. I think the people who have stuck with it quite often were in it before, or people who are sticking with it on a less emotional basis and a more persistent basis. Okay. Nevertheless, I would say that I think the 60s were very important. It was emotional, that's true, but it did expose a lot of issues to a broader range of people. And while there were many mistakes that happened, I think there was a very large educational process that has continued since then. I think if you pick up the school textbooks now, for example, you'll see really some good material on ecology. Before then, ecology is a science, not as a political movement. Before then, there were very, very little of that. When I go back to getting the technical expertise, that's very difficult. I'll tell you one person, just to give you a kind of a history of the kind of person that sometimes gets into this. This person, Gil, he's now about, 34, 35, graduated from the Naval Academy. Very, very much, I would say, committed to the American ideals. Very idealistic. He joined the Navy then after graduation and became a career man. Was involved in the underwater as a frogman and a number of other things. And then the 60s made a jolt on him. And I'll tell you how the 60s made a jolt. And he wasn't part of the movement, but it influenced him. And I'll tell you how, in a very human way, because I think it happened to a lot of people. He was sent to Vietnam. The anti-Vietnam War movement began, and his wife became part of it. And he got a Dear John letter while in Vietnam, basically his wife saying she's leaving him because she cannot accept that he's part of the war. So this is a big emotional blow to him. And he's involved, he's an officer there, and he's reporting, you remember the body counts that they used to have back then? I mean, it's kind of, we'd like to forget about it, but they were keeping score. And this was part because we had computers, of course, that were trying to tell us how we were winning. And of course, they didn't work very well. Well, he would write in these reports, and then he'd read the evaluation of his reports, which were very different. And so he went back to headquarters in Saigon, and he went with a classmate, and he says, or some friends back there, and he saw how the information was, as it passed from one section to another, was polished, was made more optimistic, was changed. And this, he found, of course, being a conscientious person, very, very distressing, because he had some of his own people there who were dying, and of course, that's what war is about. So he began to be more forceful in documenting all his information, and he began to get criticized for being a pessimist, because he was saying, look, all of these rates, casualty rates, are being inflated, he says, and he began to document it. Well, they sent out a crew of an officer, a group of officers out there, not so much to investigate, to find out what all the mistakes were, but to investigate his work, and they later told him with the idea of possibly court-martialing him. Well, he had all his documentation down, and so they couldn't court-martial him. Well, he became quite disenchanted, I think you could see, with the military, and he left, and he became a monitor on the Alaska pipeline. Figured he'd get away to Alaska. Well, the same thing happened there. He began reporting the material. He began reporting the material. He figured that was his duty, his obligation, his job description. And he found nothing happened. And he found just the opposite, that he'd read the reports that came out, the public reports, and they were much better than what he was reporting. So finally, he pressed on this, and he got fired. So he sued under the Freedom of Information Act, which is a law that basically says that the public is entitled to public information, to find out why he was fired. Well, they offered him his job back when he did this, and he would not accept it. Well, to make a long story short, he went and he won his case, Freedom of Information, and found out some of the reasons, which were far from being idealistic, of why he got fired. Well, here was a young man, very idealistic, and he went through the Vietnam War experience, seeing, you know, men who served under him dying, and seeing information manipulated. Then he decides to go to Alaska to kind of get away from it all, and gets caught in the same thing, loses his wife in the process. Well, he became very committed to go ahead and fight some of what he felt were the injustices, that the idealism that he went into, which at first made him very loyal to institutions such as the military, now was being used to question those very same institutions. So these are the kinds of people that maybe got influenced by the 60s. They weren't part of it, but now he's involved in it, and he's made some rather significant sacrifices to do this. So the environmental movement, I think, right now is very different. It involves a lot of legal questions. It is very different. It is not as emotional, not as much fanfare. Yet there's a core of very, very committed people, which I think have a very significant spiritual depth to what they do. And I'm not including the people who are just trying to make the news. I mean, there's always those group of people. They try to get onto the news. They try to make a big show. We know that. I'm really involved with the people who are really committed, or really what I'm talking about are the people who are very committed to this and aren't particularly seeking a whole lot of publicity. I think they're very much concerned for social justice, and I think that they have approaching their work with a significant spiritual depth, I believe.
Could I ask you, sure. Do all the universities and colleges now have a major in environmental protection or something like that? I don't know what they call it.
I don't think so.
There are many people who are taking degrees in this. I don't know where they're getting them. But
I think the universities right now, let me see, that's all. Number one, I don't believe there are. I think there were more programs that came out of the 60s. This is true. But I think there were programs before. I don't see any significant change in the educational programs. There's been some new degree programs, and some of them very weak. I think there's a lot of bandwagon people.
I don't know anything about them, except I know a number of young people told me they're majoring in this.
They're also having a hard time getting jobs, too. Yes.
I think the terminology has changed, too. It used to be conservation, and now it's ecology.
Well, the word ecology comes from the Greek word oikos, which means house. And ecology is the study of the earth. And it's a field of science. The word has been changed. I think now, it used to be conservation. I think even the word ecology now is maybe even... is even kind of going out, because I think people are recognizing that there's more to the problem than wilderness and the concept of social justice, economics, and so forth. I don't know whether there is any one word now that is fitted. I think ecology is even becoming an old word now. You know, get your reaction on that. What do you think?
I would tend to agree with that. It's changing even the term ecology. You used to speak of ecological niches, which were groups of animals or in commune. And that was changed to meaning something of what we understand it now, and it's still evolving in relation to conserving our natural resources and social justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think conserving the resources and I think it is coming together much more. I think the concerns are, and I do think a lot of the degree programs that were set up at the universities have ended.
I don't know. Some
of them have ended. I think universities, like most human organizations, they tend to jump on bandwagons too. And some of the programs were good and some of them weren't. I'd say the interest in those courses, though, has declined. And be they good, even the good courses. I know the course I used to teach was a sophomore course, interdisciplinary course, and that's been terminated now. That's just been ended. Anyhow, does anybody else have anything else in general, as a general observation, in terms of what they might see in terms of what we've referred to as the environmental movement?
I see most of the big industries having one or two technical people oriented in effluent treatment and so forth.
Right. I think the treatment process part, I think has, yeah.
No, it's not lip service. They're very much interested in it because
the law says so.
The state's climbing all over them.
Right. There's an interesting part concerning the industries. Certainly they have, in many, particularly in terms of treatment, they have changed many of their ways of doing things. It's very interesting, though, how it comes across in the media, and I've been involved in a number of these things. You'll have a government agency fighting a particular kind of pollutant, say the fluorocarbons. Remember from the spray cans that were building up and diffusing up into the upper atmosphere? For phosphorus and detergents, you remember those? And there'll be a tremendous battle, legal battle, and usually a government agency supported by private research quite often, or university research, will be locked in a battle with, political battle, with the industries. And if the government agency wins it, and you decide to ban fluorocarbons, you'll see within a short period of time advertisements in the media about our product from the same industries is now very environmentally sound. We've eliminated the fluorocarbons and so forth, which is true. They have, but the fight that went before it, of course, isn't included in the TV commercials. So it's true the industries have changed, and I think it's been a sincere change. But it has been a battle, and that's the way the system works.
What is the connection with them? I don't know if you'd call them environmentalists, but aren't scientists always searching out many of these things, pointing these out? And I don't know if you call them environmentalists or not.
Well, I think
this is one of the goals of science, is to protect the life on this earth.
I think you'd find that all disciplines are somehow related in some way to understanding of the earth, and of course our relationship to it. The problem with science and engineering both is it tends to be disciplinary, and they deal with a piece of the problem. And the you know, fortunately or unfortunately, everything's all interconnected. And so what happens is the problems are very much interdisciplinary. And in general, interdisciplinary studies have failed. They are, for various social reasons, that they're very difficult to make an interdisciplinary investigation. It's very difficult. So if a particular problem fits within the concerns of a particular scientific discipline, then it's easier for that science to identify that problem. But if it involves a combination of several disciplines, then it's very difficult. So I think you're right that there are some problems with that. Okay?
Industry has also found that some of the pollution that they have been dumping into the air or into the water, and by cleaning it up, they've made a profit on it.
Yes.
It's one of the big things that has come out of this. They fought for a long time, but now they find them profitable.
No, this is true in the cities in the waste disposal type of thing, for instance.
I think that's generally true, you know.
But again, if they had taken the lead to do it instead of having to get forced into doing it,
well,
by the pork battles, you see, that's where the problem comes in.
It's broken down where some guy has went and really studied, and he sold the companies on the idea. He's proved it. That's a major thing. You got to prove everything to somebody, or they'll believe it.
Yeah, in terms of profit.
You're right.
And there are environmental problems, of course, which don't have a profit. I mean, you're not going to make money by solving the problem.
There's far much more. There's a lot more money been put into the environmental protection than there has gotten out in profit. So that's why companies don't go looking for it.
That's true. Yes, you had
a lot of the newspapers are still trying to make people comfortable with everything the way it used to be, at least where we are. There's a significant problem, you know, with the Tacoma smelter. Our newspapers just pretend like it doesn't even exist. Banger Summer, you know, it's just a few people that are worried about getting blown up. It's kind of a petty little children. Newspapers, nothing really as significant is being reported to people.
Okay. Yes.
One thing I have to mention also is that if a particular company decides to clean up their solution and invest a lot of money investigate and so forth, and the other companies don't do it, it's sort of committed to the bank. So they're waiting for the law to pass, so all the companies have to.
That's right. I think we have to be very careful at criticizing an industry. I think, you know, of course, we're all open to criticism, but it is true that industry is involved in a competitive system. And I think it was one baseball manager that said, good guys come in last. And quite often that is true. And so this is why you need governmental action, to essentially change the rules to make it fair so that the people who do treat their waste aren't placed at a competitive disadvantage. So my criticism would probably, for a lot of the problems, would be directed more towards government as well as to the industry. And also, I think I would direct the strongest criticism towards universities, because they don't have either a profit incentive or to have to deal with, or they aren't involved in regulations, so they ought to be the ones searching out the problems. And quite often they don't do this.
Okay. I was going to make the point, you could take the example of the solar energy question now, you know, and I think among people that obviously think about it, that there's obviously more value for society if we can convert over to solar energy. I think people can agree on that aspect. And yet, you don't seem like there's no leadership at all that comes out of industry to do research and move into that direction. And ultimately, I can't help but believe it must be potentially profitable in the future to market solar energy making stuff, whatever the cells are.
Not until our present cheap energy stuff gets used up.
Yeah, but That's true, but they have to be able to acknowledge that fact that they can make it competitive. And then they look to the government only to come up with research grants to pursue it in terms of, you know, doing the research to make the system ultimately profitable.
But who's that? And we have met the enemy, and it is us. We all want cheap electricity, we want cheap gasoline, we want cheap this, we want cheap that, and you can't have a good environment and have everything cheap. It just doesn't fit in.
I think it even goes more fundamental than that.
You missed the point in terms of, yeah, but you have to, I think it is potentially cheap, it's just that you have to be able to make the investment. You have to make the investment in the future, you see, because it isn't cheap now, but it could become cheap if somebody took the time and money to develop it.
Let's put it this way.
It's a development question is what it is. And they want to develop the known resources of more oil. They want to put their money into more oil instead of putting their money into research.
Let's put it this way, that might
may get it.
The cost of our normal energy is increasing. Mm-hmm. And the cost, I think, because we haven't put in a lot of research and technical know-how into solar, the relative cost is decreasing. Relative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in terms of the future, it seems like there's a good bet on solar.
On heating and lighting.
Particularly for heating.
Not for electricity.
No.
But for heating, I think that this is a significant amount.
Yes, I know. It's going to come very fast.
And there has not been, I think Fred's right in the sense that there has not been, either in government or the universities or the industry, the greater emphasis on what might be called home solar units. And I think part of that is because institutions want things that support institutions.
Well, it's even worse than that. For instance, the government under IRDA has given a grant to be put up at, it's going to be built outside of someplace in Colorado, up in the mountain top. And that's supposed to do pure research on this business about maybe trying to make electricity as one cheaper way and so forth.
Windmills.
Yeah, and I can't forget, you're just amazing. I don't know what they got, something like $6 million or something like that. Furthermore, the persons who are going to be more or less in charge of it are way down at IRDA on the office list, you know. So you can tell that they think, well, if you want to go and piddle around up there on that mountain, you know.
Yeah, most of the IRDA research on solar energy is for big industrial-type solar plants. And I think the small solar unit for the homes has been shortchanged.
Uh-huh.
And I think if you go to a university, you look at our catalog in the university, you'll find something like 31 courses in nuclear energy and none in solar. And it's not because it has been technically decided that nuclear is so much better than solar. What has happened is you have institutions which hire the graduates.
Right.
You have institutions which have consulting for the faculty, endow chairs, and give grants. And so those are the kinds of things that get taught. So I do think that there has been in solar a neglect of that. In particular, the kind of energy that you could put on your house and cut the wire to any outside area. I think there's been a neglect of that. I think there's been a more fundamental change, though, that this has brought about. And I'd like to divert a little bit. I think that traditional economics as we know it in this country is being challenged at its basic foundations. And this is going to have long-range implications. I think there are a number of economists who are very sensitive to some of the environmental and resource limitations, who are basically proposing radical new ideas in terms of economics. And this is a change of ideas, and quite often changes of ideas have more long-term effect than, say, passing a law for this particular product or doing research on this particular one. There does seem to be a growing change that has, in part, come out of the environmental concerns that seems to be challenging basic economics. And they are challenging the concept of continued, ever-increasing material growth. They are challenging that on several grounds. First, they don't believe that it's possible to continue it that way. Second, they don't even believe that it's desirable to continue that way. So in a sense, what they're challenging is that the environmental problems can't be just solved by putting a technological device at the end of the pipe. It has to go to the other end of the pipe and see how what we're producing, how we live, how we distribute resources, in short, the basic economic way that we operate, where economics is the distribution of resources and control and incentives. Now, these economists, I think, would be very interesting to discuss at a camp like, or a place like this, the Holden Village, because I perceive in these economists a very deep theological depth. You know, I brought along Herman Daly's book, Toward a Steady State Economy, and in his introduction, he ends his introduction by a long quote from the prophet Isaiah, and he compares our worship of the gross national product increasing to idolatry, and he does a good job of it. And other economists, such as Kenneth Boulding, for example, they have a theological depth that is unmistakable. And so it seems to me that we need to, we in the church and in places like Holden Village need to maybe take some consideration of what they're trying to say. Part of it, the motivation, has come out of the environmental movement. Another part of it has come out of a recognition that technology is not something that's going to solve all our problems. And this is coming, this idea that technology is not going to solve all our problems is beginning to come out of technology itself. We're finding more technologists and more engineers concerned, including myself, about the limitations of technology and speaking up on that particular concern. So on a long-term basis, there may be some very different changes of our attitudes and ideas, but they may not catch. It may not catch, because changes of fundamental attitudes are very difficult. And there are intense battles, say within the field of economics, within the field of engineering. There are intense that probably are somewhat comparable to what Martin Luther, the battles he had to go through. You remember the debates he had to take and how he was challenged when he challenged the institutional church at that particular time, and challenged the established ways. We are seeing some of those challenges coming across now. How successful they are, we can't tell. Historians may look back and see this era as another Reformation, or they may see it as a time of decline, or they may see it somehow we have managed to pull it off. I don't know. But there is a revolution of ideas and concepts that is going on, and it's going on in the professional disciplines themselves. And economics is probably the one area which is facing the most radical challenge right now. And I do see some of the challenge as having some real theological depth. Okay, I'd like to end what I have is by referring to the church, all right, seeing as we are here at Holden Village, and how I see it fitting in to the environmental movement. In general, the church in the 60s was considered part of the establishment. I don't think we should kid ourselves that somehow, while there were exceptions, we shouldn't deny those, I don't think that the church was considered to be the motivator. In some of the literature that was written, and some people actually pointed to the Judeo-Christian tradition as the cause of the environmental problem, the actual cause. Lynn White is a historian who wrote in Science Magazine, which is probably the most popular or widespread magazine, scientific magazine, wrote a book or an article on the environmental crisis, and he traced it back to the injunction in Genesis, be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. And this was in the 1960s, generally widely accepted in the 1960s. it was reinforced the idea that maybe Christianity was a part cause of the environmental problem, was generally encouraged because churches tend to support or appear to support established authority. Many churches tend to appear very authoritarian, and they tend quite often to discourage in-depth questions. This is how it's seen. And Holden Village, of course, I think is the exception, one of the notable exceptions. Not only that, but we found in the 60s and now that the current idea that you can do whatever you want with your resources is defended as a God-given right. A God-given right. So a person says, I own this, like that mountain out there, therefore I can do whatever I want to with it, and so we have a pile of tailings. Only now the problem is a little more severe because it's more global, the problems are more persistent and more severe. So many of the objections to kind of stopping some of the environmental problems were defended on the ground, this is my God-given right to go ahead and use my resources, my land, my factory, or whatever, in any way that I want to. That was kind of the attitude that prevailed or was said in the 60s. Anybody want to add anything on that? On the 60s, we're not talking about the exceptions, or just the general attitude towards churches. It was not considered, at least in the beginning of the 60s, was not considered to be one of the supporters of greater environmental concerns. Okay. I think Holden Village would be an exception, as Holden Village, I think, has always had a tradition of wrestling with these questions, quite often long before they ever came out and became, you know, popular. And what about the 70s since then? I think the churches have changed somewhat. I'm a little cautious on how far they have. I think their different denominations have made statements at their conventions concerning the importance of environmental concerns, but they tend to be very general statements. The question of whether the church is going to really be an action or a force in actually changing some of our attitudes, this will have to wait. We really cannot say. I do find, however, that many of the people who have maintained their commitments, who have not been the ones to just simply jump on the bandwagon, I would have to say that they are religious people. They have a spiritual depth to them, but maybe an uncomfortable feeling about institutional churches. They may belong to them, they may even be a part of the clergy, but there's been an uncomfortable feeling about the institutional church. But they are very committed Christians. I'll give you one example. A man by the name of Doug Still. And Doug was involved in a number of initiative petitions. He's in his 40s or 50s, I guess. He's extremely intelligent, extremely capable. I mean, extremely. You know that he could have made it in any area. And I went to a meeting. He belonged to the Center for Environmental Action, which is a Christian interdenominational environmental group. And Doug at the time, and Joyce was with me at the time, Doug at the time had received information that he had a brain tumor and that he was dying of cancer. And he wanted to hire a replacement at that time so that he would have enough time to teach this person something before one of two things happened, before he degenerated so much that he couldn't do that, or he would have to have an operation, a brain operation, in which he may not come out anything more than a vegetable. He hadn't made the decision. So we were at this meeting, and Joyce can maybe add something on this. It was one of the most moving experiences I've ever been involved in, to see someone like this face that. And he and his wife were there. And we had a group of about a dozen people, and we were in tears. We were just felt for this person, and they were giving us the strength. I mean, here, he's the one dying, you know, and he's giving us the strength. And we had a communion service. And for the first time, I really got the sense of what a Last Supper was. What a Last Supper was. Well, it turned out, Doug hasn't died yet. He hasn't given up. And that was about a year ago. He's still hanging in there, still facing these continual tests and chemotherapy. But there's a person I have no doubt is one of the most committed Christians I've ever met. No doubt. But he's not the traditional Christian in the church. He's not. Now how, whether the church is going to encourage more people like this, whether the church is going to provide places like Holden where radical thoughts and ideas get bounced around, and where theology is really taken seriously in terms of the world, that's something I think only historians are going to be able to look back and say. I think certainly that is the role of the church. Certainly if we look at the Bible and see the roles of the prophets, we find that they were a pretty radical bunch. So I'll leave my assessment of where the institutional church is. I'll pass on that. And maybe in 10 or 20 years, maybe I'll be able to say something about that. But that's something that's going to depend upon what you and I do, of course. Okay, I'd like to end my part there, and I'd like to just kind of open it up to any kinds of ideas on anything that we've said so far. Yes?
Do you think that the church as a whole can agree to such an extent that we can't take
things? I hope we could agree on something. You know, something. You know, we can't change the whole world. You know, we can't. But I would hope that something that somehow we could at least agree enough to do something. Because that would say something about us if we couldn't agree on anything. And I think we'd have to do a lot of homework. I think we'd have to work hard. I don't think we should just go on out and fly off the handle. But certainly we ought to agree that we ought to encourage more of the kind of dialogue that happens at home. You know, I think that kind of thing we could agree on. Yes?
You can't get very far with this church business until you get the Catholic Church to drop that be fruitful and multiply business. That's where the problem really comes from.
Well, that's part of it, but
I think... I mean, if you didn't have people, you wouldn't have the problem, would you?
I think we have to do it. I think really what we have to do is what Christ is. I think we have to look at the beam in our own eye, and then maybe we can help get the splinter out of someone else's. I think the Catholic Church is going to have to face that.
Well,
I think
the
they
Catholic
are.
Christians are already pretty well solid. They're probably
I think they already are. Somebody in the back, yeah.
I think the other thing that really speaks to us, if you take the commandments and apply them to nature, which when they were given, you didn't have that need because the world seemed limitless, but take stealing, committing adultery in the sense of using nature and killing, those three commandments, and point them towards nature instead of people. And I think you can see a lot of sins.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the concept of stewardship has always been part of the church.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that has been emphasized in some instances, in perhaps a very small way, about that we have a responsibility. The world is not ours. The world belongs to everybody, and that we do have responsibilities for its care. And I think this one, that is a very much accepted thing in general.
That is also a radical concept. Because if you say that at a public hearing, and someone starts implying that you're a communist, which, I mean, that happens. What do you do? You know? And I can tell you what I did at one. I said, well, you're holding up a piece of paper that says I have the right to do what I want with my land. That's my deed. And I said, you know what I call that? I call that Tetzelism. Remember who John Tetzel was? John Tetzel was one of the people that helped bring about the Reformation. He worked for the Catholic Church, and he sold indulgences. He said, you can buy this piece of paper, and it forgives you for your sins, even ones you haven't committed yet. And I think that's how people look at their deeds. But what you have said, I agree, is a fundamental Christian concept, but I think it would be a very radical one in terms of resolving it with the notion of private property. That's where it gets difficult.
We had a couple of weeks ago, we had a discussion in adult class in Sunday school, and we looked at it this way. the environment, well, you and I are neighbors, but our environment's our neighbor too. And there's a saying, love your neighbor as you would yourself. So I think that's about the best conclusion you can come up with, is to use our environment as our neighbor, to love it as much as ourselves.
I agree with you. I think the moral basis is there. What we need to do, though, and we need to do our homework, and I think this is what you were saying, we've got to translate that into some action. And I think we should begin by that, by action which involves ourselves. Now, I think we can say, well, how come the Indians don't control their population, and how come this country doesn't do that? But I think we need to take that motivation, and then we have to seriously examine the way we do things and its consequences, and then try to come up with some action that makes, or some way of doing things that makes our behavior more consistent with that attitude.
There's another, we had head of the Communicable Disease Control Center in Atlanta, Georgia, spoke for our group also, and he was in India, and he was in charge of the smallpox vaccination over there. And he made a comparison of, you know, how we say India should control their population because, you know, they have so many people and they can't feed them. But he came up and he says that for every child that we have in the United States, the resources that he uses, it takes 16 Indian children to use those same amount. So,
and we've been very spendthrift, and we take them from other nations, not just our own.
So we can't look at them, we have to look at ourselves.
And they're going to have to look at themselves.
Right, right, they have to look at themselves.
And we may be able to learn from each other, too.
That's true, the whole Western world, too. One thing that struck me being in Europe all spring was that the Europeans have never gotten to this wasteful attitude that we have. They don't have hot water heaters that are on all the time, consuming vast amounts of energy to keep this water on just in case I want to wash my hands. If you want hot water over there, you go and turn the darn thing on. You know, and you have to decide. One place we lived, we had briquettes to heat the hot water, and if you didn't remember to light your fire.
No, they also can conserve on heat energy, like you wear coats.
Oh, yes. And you only use much.
That's first supper. Anybody who wants to stick around can for second. But thank you, and stick around if you want to add anything else.
Can't we consider wilderness areas, parks, the Ocean Shore Management Act as a start?
Oh, definitely. I think it's, but the acts are very general, like the 1969 Environmental Policy Act is one of the best statements of values that I've seen. But now we've got to really put it into action in a way that has social justice, that doesn't throw a whole lot of people out of work. We've got to try it. I agree with you that the laws, I think, are there. Whether the spirit of the laws can be fulfilled, though, without us changing a whole lot of other things, I don't know.
I hear somebody say one time it's computer population control. Countries that traditionally have large families as compared to here where the traditional family is
smaller.
Two point six or something like that.
Yeah.
Is that their joy comes from, at least their worldly joy comes from their family. To have a large family is a considerable amount of social security.
That's true.
And here, our worldly joy comes from our possessions.
But her point also that security comes from your children.
Mm-hmm.
You have enough children so that when you get old, there'll be a few of them alive to support you.
Take care of you.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Do you think that technology is up with the ideal environmentalist thinking? Do you think that the environmentalist has the legislative or lawmaking bodies are together?
Well, I think technology plays a part in it. But I don't think that we can simply count on technology to solve all our problems. I don't think we can. And I think that the legislature, I think you mentioned the legislatures, legislators are quite often are followers. I mean,
they do what the people want them to do.
Yeah, and so if we as both individuals and corporate bodies,
they want to get elected.
That's true. That's right.
Some legislatures have passed laws against the people's will.
Yeah, they get out of office in a big hurry then.
They sometimes have passed laws that are for the benefit of the people, but they do not see it.
Well, that's part of the...
I thought one thing I had thought we might discuss is what I see is, now for instance, I'm from California. We've just come through this big hassle with the Redwoods area, for instance. As you know, the people took their trucks and whatnot all the way to Washington and protested and said that it was completely unnecessary to enlarge the Redwoods area and so on. Well, this sort of thing of how to, I think in some ways, we have now gotten the idea the environmentalists are a bunch of, starry-eyed people who don't know much about the world of reality and who are trying to make us go back to the days of the Indians and, live like that. And I think that that's partly what's been the problem in getting the environmental movement popular, is that either, I don't know if it's really so, but this is a common feeling, like, oh well, those goofs again, they don't know what the world is really like. You have to have compromises, and they don't want to compromise at all, they want it 100% their way. And what is the problem? How is that? Is that a real problem? And if so, how is it ever going to get solved?
You asked two questions. The first one I might be able to answer. I'm not sure how it's going to get solved. I think I can understand a lot of the environmental's concern and being very dogmatic, because let me give one example. Let's suppose you have a river, and it's a beautiful natural river, and you're trying to decide whether to put a dam on it or not. You can decide not to put a dam on it 10 times, and you don't have a dam, but you still can build a dam. But once you build that dam, you can't decide the other way. So what happens is a lot of the decisions are relatively irreversible. Once a 1,000-year tree is cut down, it's down, you don't make any more. So people become very, very sensitive about decisions which are relatively irreversible, because they feel like any compromise, if we continue compromising, each step of the way, something like a 1,000-year-old tree will be gone, and it can't get replaced. And so I think that's where they get very, very upset. If it involved cutting down some bushes that grew up in 5 or 10 years, I don't think there would be the controversy. So I think that's part of where they're coming from. Now, the question of what to do about this, I think this is why the concern for social justice has to be taken together with the environmental concern. Because to say, let's protect the trees, and then somehow this means that a whole group of families are thrown out of work and without an income, there's something wrong in that. There's something unfair and unjust. And so I think now we're finding that the more mature environmentalists are trying to deal with both problems at the same time. Now, of course, if you live and you've hiked and lived with those redwoods and you love them, you're going to respond with an emotional passion for them, and that's understandable. And it's just as understandable if you're a logger there who has a home and has to make mortgage payments and pay for their kids' clothes and so forth, that you would also react with that emotional passion. So I understand the passion, and I can't give a specific answer. All I can say is environmental concerns and social justice, they have to be taken together. They have to be taken together. And I think we certainly see that from the biblical tradition. You know, those are always
been together. Those of us, now, I don't know. I mean, I like the redwoods, but I don't know whether they should be cut down or not. I mean, maybe some of them should be cut down. Maybe there ought to be other trees planted. They grow faster. If we need a lot of wood, why should we keep all the redwoods or something like that? I don't know who to believe. That's what I'm really trying to say.
Well, would it be possible, perhaps, to leave enough for aesthetic value and take the rest?
Then the question is, how much is enough? Jerry, you're back there.
Yeah, I was wondering if you'd apply that same formula to the manufacture of military hardware. Like you said, I'm being paid very handsomely to design instruments to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
Human justice, again, insofar as I think the human problem in there is very real, but are we maybe faced with an ultimate in the biblical sense of the very philosophy by which, or theology by which we function? It says this thing is ultimately wrong, and therefore I am involved in something that is wrong.
Yeah,
how do you react to that?
Do you want to react to that?
Yeah,
okay, I'll let him react.
Well, that brings up another point, you know. Who is to say what is right and what is wrong? And in private property, if the individual that owns the property doesn't say, I want to do this with my property, then who does?
And then,
well, the property, in a sense, really doesn't belong to you. That's what I think. It belongs to all of us. It belongs to all of us, and it belongs to God, yes.
Okay, well, this is you remember the book Animal Farm?
And I don't care what every property you have, that's true.
You remember the book Animal Farm?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that the philosophy that he felt? Take it away from these individuals and give it to groups or another group?
Well, I don't necessarily believe that.
Well, can I give you two examples here? Where I live, there was one mountain near there. It was right in the middle of town, very scenic. The owner says, I want to build roads up the place. And everybody says, why? Well, he says, well, for their fire roads, they'll keep the place from burning down. And so everybody says, go ahead. And so the next thing you know, there was this great restaurant starting on top of the mountain. And so how do you judge against that? There's another place, they were starting to build high apartments. And so the local people in back of them, whose view was cut off from the sea, decided that they'd like to stop it. So they wrote to their state legislature saying that there's a water shortage, so you can't let them build. And so the legislatures, who didn't know about the conditions of water in that town, decided, okay, nobody builds in that town for 3 years. And so then the same people that cried before are now crying again for a different purpose, to be able to build more houses. So the thing is, it's a very complex question as to who decides.
Like, back to Jerry's, I just want to finish so on his question. Are you basically saying, how do you deal with the broader question, Jerry?
No, what I was asking was whether you applied the same criteria to, and you said it was a two-sided issue. People are involved as well as a natural resource. Would you apply the same thing to this other thing, which has gotten a great deal of attention, has a great many people concerned about you know, the ethics involved in war itself, and our ability to, it's like Mark Hatfield said in one of his books, he says that no weapon has ever been built that man has not used. No, that's Harold Hughes that said that.
Harold Hughes.
Not Howard Hughes, Harold Hughes.
Harold Hughes.
Former governor of Iowa.
So you're talking maybe about the ethics of how, let me see, the ethical question of someone working within that, or the question of supporting a person who's working within
that? Do you keep that industry going in order to provide jobs? I guess that's something that is not applied in our Southern California area to a great extent. Mm-hmm. But,
first of all, that's a horrible way to provide jobs. Yeah. I mean, even if you didn't, if you weren't worried about war, because I mean, the amount of money that you could use to support one engineer
and material.
If you want to just provide jobs, your best thing to do is subsidize Shakespearean theater, for example. You can get people who would be delighted to go ahead and be a Shakespearean theater actor for maybe $8,000 a year, whereas you'd never get a military engineer for that. And not only that, but they don't use resources.
So Human services.
One of the problems with the human, human services on that. And I'd include, theater and so forth.
The arts.
Supporting big technology, I don't see as a way of providing jobs. But then there's another ethical question that I see you groping at, let me take a part of that, is what about the person, what is their ethical response when they actually find themselves working within that system? What do they do?
Well, this man that I'm talking about is agonizing with it at this point.
I don't see it as too related in that lumber is a renewable resource. It can be planted again, they can grow. We're not going to have 1,000-year-old trees, unfortunately. But we can use the same land upon which these trees are growing to grow other trees that we do use for building purposes and many other functions. Even recreation.
But we're not going to have 1,000-year-old trees. And the problem comes is, if you have a lot of 1,000-year-old trees, then it's not so important.
True.
But as the size decreases, and of course we know this from economics, as the supply diminishes, the value of it goes up. Okay? And the size has diminished. So we reach a point as it gets smaller and smaller where the conflict increases greater and greater. And the idea of having a 1,000-year-old tree or a 100-year-old tree or a 500-year-old tree becomes more and more important. So you ultimately reach that same kind of confrontation, although I think in the case, maybe you're pointing out the case of Jerry, it's a little more direct.
Well, maybe I didn't see what he was trying to point out, but war is destructive and... Mm-hmm.
Just think for a minute of all the waste that you can think of in the whole world. I think the worst right now is all these armaments that everybody is accumulating. Look at how they cost billions and billions and billions of dollars. And they're taking human beings' labor is being put in that. Skills are being put in that are just wasted. And worse than wasted, because they're not only no good, they're harmful. and yet here we all sit and we think it's so terrible, that they're polluting the rivers, instead of thinking how terrible it is that we're still allowing this to happen in the world. It just shows that human beings are not very bright.
But now that it's all started, and it hasn't been very
bright, it's sinful.
How do you stop it?
Yeah, well, I should say that something is very, very rotten in Denmark, that's what I'd say.
Well, I think we'd agree with it.
Call us Danes.
Well, it all started out as priorities, and what it was the first priority. And what we have to do is you have to continue reevaluate and change your priorities.
Well, you don't have to sell armaments to both Israel and the Arabs. That's ridiculous.
Well, yeah, I see a very big conflict. It's doing neither any good.
No. But
see, that comes back again to the environmental, because one of the reasons why we do sell that is to make up for the balance of payments, because we're importing so much oil. Because we drive big cars.
That's right. Speaking of balance, very, very. We were talking a little earlier about...
I'll get to that. Let's go. He had his hand up before. Let me get here.
Can we have our cake and eat it too?
I
absolutely.
Two years ago.
And we want to.
It's okay to want to.
No, we can't. We've got to face the consequences of whatever we do, and sure. We've got to try and face them honestly.
Right.
I think back. Okay, let me. I cut you off, so go ahead.
Okay, we were talking earlier. The lady mentioned something about the research into new sources of energy are being curtailed mm-hmm. because of price, and that costs are going up. But right now, we're facing an artificial pricing on some of our energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a real, true source. And consequently, our balance of payments is not in our favor. Most of it is going to the Mideast right now. Mm-hmm. And
this still comes back to, if you use more, you got to import more.
That's right.
And if you import more, you have to have a balance of payments. Jane?
And it's like increasing the amount of research to maintain a standard of living on the assumption that our present standard of living is healthy and really okay.
Yeah.
And I believe it's not. I believe it's too much.
How do you get people to stop them?
That's a very good question.
Well, that's it. You see, as long as that's why I said we've met the enemy and it is us.
Yeah,
we are to blame for the environmental mess that we've got. We're to blame for it, but we won't accept the blame. We say, oh, it's a terrible factory over there, or it's such a, you know, these miners over there.
Jerry.
You began this session with something I think is awfully important. That is that maybe we need to define where our vested interests
mm-hmm.
are.
That's true.
Because whether it's on the university, whether it's in industry, whether it's in the theology of the church or the organized church, that you're speaking about a lot of parallels that exist
that's
within
right.
the church.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's why I would say a place like Holden for the church is very important, because it is a place where the church itself can be criticized. And that's why I feel, you know, for myself, that one of the institutions that I criticize the most is the university, because I'm a part of the university. It's not because I don't like the university. So I think you're right.
But questions need to be asked, unpopular as they might be, and I'm thinking specifically here of the church, it can be applied in probably every area of this. But questions need to be asked, I think that there have to be those of us who are going to be willing to ask the questions and take the consequences that come along. Because if we're, you know, primarily, and we've been talking a good deal within the last week or two about the meaning of community, and that, you know, really what is important. We've got a big, huge organization. We are a nationwide, worldwide organization of the church. But I think we was very indicative here the other night, a week or so ago, that an awful lot of people are awful hungry for reality, or for a reality that will be satisfying, and not just some play act that goes on week after week through the same thing over and over again, and walking away without anything.
Yeah.
And I would guess primarily that we come to Holden because we know we can find some of that here.
That's right. It's better to expose the problems that we know that are there than pretend that they're not there.
Why can't we find it?
But it's dangerous.
Oh, it's dangerous.
You better believe it's dangerous.
That's right. Well, I mean, the Bible has a lot of people who did that and ended up getting killed. Christ.
Why can't we find it in our parishes, though? That's where the front line action really is. Why are they so fragile? What's going to happen to them if we challenge? Or are we going to be so terribly judgmental with our people, you know, that we lose before we even start?
Yeah, like we tried to talk about the nuclear thing policy when that was a referendum in California, and the parish didn't want to talk about it. They were kind of afraid to talk about it, said that wasn't the business of the church to talk about that.
I think that is the thing, the most discouraging thing about the church, if you want to call, I don't know what the church really is, frankly, but the idea that we still have, let's not have any dissension, you know, and as long as we all talk about, let's all get to heaven, we will all be happy together.
Right.
As soon as we talk about practical things like nuclear energy, we're going to get into trouble, so let's keep away from it. And I think, really, that's very true of the churches.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay, well, it was in those years you were talking about that the seminaries put out ministers who were, really learned in going out and revolutionizing the community. And the community didn't accept them.
Many of them quit.
Well, do they do that, though? I don't know. Is that what seminaries do?
Right now, I guess it's a matter of having all the 4 years while they're in seminary, they go out to the communities, not just the one intern year, but the other years as well, so that they know what's going on in the community.
Okay, you had...
Yeah, well, she was talking about the churches and discussions, and I just mentioned before that we have a class of people that group meet at Sunday school. We bring our children to Sunday school, and he was asking where can we start in our own parish. And we've been holding these discussions, on social issues here lately, and I think, if every church would start this, and it strengthens your church. This is a year of outreach in the Lutheran Church.
I think one thing that has to happen, though, you have to try and investigate some one thing, no matter how small it is, that you can do. Because it gets horribly depressing to just go on out and talk about all the problems and not do anything. And that's one of the problems.
Some people aren't aware. They've never, I could care less about it. But, if you convince that one person, just like a Christian, if I can convince one person to become a Christian, I feel good for the rest all the time. And same way with this, if I can convince one person that there's something wrong and we should do something about it.
But we have to also deal with our own helplessness. I think there's a real element of Christian theology in here, because if you study the problems rationally, you end up and say, there's nothing I can do. And I found this with my students, and I was sharing a couple of people on this. We teach a course, and a graduate course, sharp students, and we deal with some of these issues, and they become horribly depressed. And so I try to convince them that they could make a difference. And to be honest, they won. I didn't convince them. In fact, I was getting depressed. So I tried a bit of Christian theology without calling it that, and here's what I said. It was, well, try and find some one thing that you can do. Certainly you can find something. And then I said, now say to yourself, it won't make a bit of difference if I do it. So they say, it won't make a bit of difference. Then I said, now say to yourself, I'll probably get in trouble if I do it. So they'd say, I'll probably get in trouble if I do it. And then I said, now say, but I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah. And when they did that, a big smile came on their face. Uh-huh. And that to me is spirit. That's spirit. And it's Holy Spirit. Holy means transcending. You transcend the rationality. Okay? Spirit is like a horse has spirit. So you transcend the rationality, and you say, I'm going to do it anyhow because I have spirit, and a smile comes on your face, and you go ahead and you do it. Okay?
That means also that you've come to a conclusion on the value system.
Right.
Huh?
That means that you have come to a conclusion on, I'll add another word, on what generally would be termed as a radical value system.
Mm-hmm.
It's radical only because radical. It's different than the commonly accepted one.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. But it, in essence, you're dealing with a different concept.
Well, you're dealing basically with saying, yeah, it's impossible, and then you get this hope anyhow. Isn't that Christianity?
The price.
60s idealism.
is probably you're gaining an inner peace and inner strength. You may sacrifice some of the affluence of
you may sacrifice a great deal.
Washington or Oregon living.
That's true.
Because you may lose your job.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. I think there are a few examples in the Bible on that.
Well, I think one thing that's very important, if churches are going to discuss these issues, that whoever is the leader, whether it's a pastor or the Sunday school teacher or whatnot, that they don't have a preconceived idea about what everybody shall think when they come out of the discussion.
Well, that's true.
And that's so often the case. I think that's the one thing that alienates a lot of people. is that they know what this person, you know, is going to say is the only right answer, and it has to really be honest. Research on what is really, what is the issue, and what are the pros and cons of the variables and so on. And that's not easy to do because we're all human beings and we do have very strong opinions.
It doesn't depend on impartiality though, doesn't it? It depends on letting both sides be heard in an honest way.
Yeah, in an honest way.
And you don't want to have intimidation.
No, that's it.
And you can't imply that the Bible is necessarily going to take sides on the issue either.
No.
Well, and it may.
It may.
But
I don't think we'd all agree it doesn't take sides in the sense that anyone can point and say it's got to be this way. In an absolutist way, you can't interpret.
Well, but I mean, within certain spheres, the Bible is going to be very definite in some way.
I think that would be an interesting Bible study sometime for a biblical scholar, to Old Testament scholar, to really, particularly, to go through what statements in the Bible really did pertain directly to environmental issues. I've never heard any study of that.
Have you ever taken the Bethel Bible series?
Pardon?
Have you ever taken
it? No, I haven't. Yeah.
There's a section in the beginning of the Bethel Bible series, and it's about man, you know, creation of man. And when he sins, you know, he falls in disharmony with God himself and the environment. And there's a picture in there. And every time we talk about the environment or there's a discussion on it, I always get this picture back in my mind. And that's right there is the basis. And we're still in disharmony with even how good we're living. You know, we have electric lights, we have warm heat and everything. But still we're in disharmony with our environment. And when we are back in harmony, we won't have these problems. And so there's your biblical answer. I believe that is your biblical answer.
But I think maybe what you're saying, I mean, you're not going to be able to go into your concordance and look up nuclear power and find out.
But basically, that's...
Yeah, I agree, but that's kind of a general philosophical...
Yeah, but you can apply that to anything that you can apply that to anything that, I mean, you know, there's basic truths and
Oh, I agree with you entirely, but it'd be nice to have, you know, sort of the real, if there are, what the direct statements that speak to that are, you know, sort of just to reinforce that idea.
What'd you say?
Enough redwoods is 10.4 acres.
It's according to Deuteronomy.
I think one of the things that maybe is consistently there is the danger of wealth. I mean, Christ says, what is it? It's easier to get a camel through the eye of a needle than to have a rich man into the kingdom of God. And I don't know what the literalists are doing with that one. I think there's a whole lot of those things in terms of the dangers of wealth. But I think what you were pointing out is you have to face some of the risks. There are going to be some risks when you go ahead and raise some of these issues. I think that's true.
But I think you gotta also approach it not from the standpoint of being a rebel searching for a cause, because I think the Lauren here was referring to some of that earlier. You know, I think the 60s maybe saw that more with the clergymen out there, weekend marchers. You know, and then they have enough data to go out and lecture for 6 months. You know, when I was in Selma, was there for maybe 6 hours. One of the analogies that I think about is that we lived through the Watts riots down there. We're fairly nearby, safe enough, or far enough away to be safe. But the there were nothing down there. And yet, go off to Alabama or wherever else, and then march for a few hours from home and be an expert.
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Between a lot of these issues, I think of the San Joaquin Valley, of the issue of the farm worker, and I think maybe the issues that involve human beings are maybe the prime ones.
I would say so too.
But I went through, I sat in the one of the downtown hotels late one night arguing with a fellow who was part of a district office in one of the districts in Minnesota about the, he had never been to the San Joaquin Valley, but boy, the only thing to do was boycott grapes. I said, well, what about the men who have invested their lives in this and are serving, are offering a product, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't matter. And then it finally broke it up. And the thing that broke me up was, and the whole ring of people that were sitting around this arena, was he says, don't say anything about talking. He says, because it's a good thing we can argue now, because 5 years from now we'll be shooting at each other.
How long ago was that?
That was about 8, 9 years ago.
Oh, okay. You made it through then.
The old Research and Social Action Committee.
You won.
That is Minneapolis.
That's why grapes are 98 cents a pound.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's enough for now. Yes, one.
One question I have to ask. How many Christians, how many people would be Christians if they didn't have any fuel to heat the church for them on a cold day in Colorado, Minnesota?
Oh, I don't know. But I think there have been a lot of Christians that have had to face a lot worse adversities.
If you read the current issue, August issue of Reader's Digest, there's a prolific writer in there that has written an article called Life Without Fuel.
Nobody's denying that life without fuel would be cold. Okay.